Exactly, she acted in accord with her heart. If only she had found the words to tell me, "That is not how you do it," she should have said, stopping me in the act. "If you want to learn how to do it, ask your friend with the black eyes." Then she should have continued, so as not to leave me without hope, "But if you want to love me, you will have to turn your back on him and learn your lesson elsewhere." If she had told me then, if I had understood her, if I had been in a position to understand her, if I had believed her, if I had been in a position to believe her, I might have saved myself from a year of confused and futile gestures of expiation. For I was not, as I like to think, the indulgent, pleasure-loving opposite of the cold, rigid colonel. I was the lie that empire tells itself when times are easy. He, the truth that empire tells when harsh winds blow. Two sides of imperial rule, no more, no less. But I temporized. I looked around this obscure frontier, this little backwater with its dusty summers, and its cartloads of apricots, and its long siestas, and its shiftless garrison, and the water birds flying in and flying out year after year to and from the dazzling, waveless sheet of the lake. And I said to myself, "Be patient. One of these days he will go away. One of these days quiet will return. Then our siestas will grow longer, and our swords rustier. The watchman will sneak down from his tower to spend the night with his wife. The mortar will crumble till lizards nest between the bricks and owls fly out of the belfry. And the line that marks the frontier on the maps of empire will grow hazy and obscure till we are blessedly forgotten." Thus I seduced myself, taking one of the many wrong turnings I have taken, on a road that looks true, but has delivered me into the heart of a labyrinth. In the dream, I am advancing towards her over the snow-covered square. At first, I walk. Then, as the wind gathers force, I begin to be driven forward in a cloud of whirling snow, with arms extended on either side, and the wind catching my cloak like a boat sail. Gathering speed, my feet skimming over the ground, I swoop down upon the solitary figure at the center of the square. "She will not turn and see me in time," I think. I open my mouth to cry out a warning. A thin wail comes to my ears, whipped away by the wind, borne up into the sky like a scrap of paper. I am almost upon her. I am already tensing myself for the impact when she turns and sees me. For an instant, I have a vision of her face. The face of a child, glowing, healthy, smiling on me without alarm before we collide. Her head strikes me in the belly. Then I am gone, carried by the wind. The bump is as faint as the stroke of a moth. I am flooded with relief. Then I need not have been anxious, after all, I think. I try to look back, but all is lost from sight in the whiteness of the snow. My mouth is covered in wet kisses. I spit, shake my head, open my eyes. The dog that has been licking my face backs off, wagging its tail. Light seeps through the doorway of the hut. I crawl out into the dawn. Sky and water are tinged with the same rosiness. The lake, where I have grown used to seeing every morning the blunt, proud fishing boats, is empty. The camp where I stand is empty too. I wrap myself tighter in my cloak and walk up the road past the main gate, which is still closed, as far as the northwest watchtower, which does not appear to be manned. Then back down the road and cutting across the fields over the earth wall towards the lakeside. A hare starts at my feet and dashes away in a zigzag. I keep track of it until it has circled back and is lost behind the ripe wheat in the far fields. A little boy stands in the middle of the path, 50 yards from me, peeing. He watches the arc of his urine, watching me too out of the corner of his eye, curving his back to make the last spurt go further. Then, with his golden trail still hanging in the air, he is suddenly gone, snatched away by a dark arm from the reeds. I stand on the spot where he stood. There is nothing to be seen but tossing reed crests, through which flickers the dazzling half-globe of the sun. "You can come out," I say, barely raising my voice. "There is nothing to be afraid of." The finches, I notice, are avoiding this patch of reeds. I have no doubt the 30 pairs of ears hear me. I turn back to the town. The gates are open. Soldiers, heavily armed, poke around among the huts of the fisherfolk. The dog that awoke me trots with them from hut to hut, tail high, tongue lolling, ears alert. One of the soldiers heaves at the rack where the gutted and salted fish hang to dry. It comes creaking down. "Don't do that," I call, hurrying my steps. Some of these men I recognize from the long days of torment in the barracks yard. "Don't do it. It wasn't their fault." With deliberate nonchalance, the same soldier now strolls over to the largest of the huts, braces himself against two of the projecting roof struts, and tries to lift the thatched roof off. Though he strains, he cannot do it. I have watched these fragile-seeming huts being built. They are built to withstand the tugging of winds in which no bird can fly. The roof frame is lashed to the uprights with thongs that pass through wedge-shaped notches. One cannot lift it without cutting the thongs. I plead with the man. "Let me tell you what happened last night. I was walking past in the dark, and the dogs began to bark. The people here were frightened. They lost their heads. You know how they are. They probably thought the barbarians had come. They ran away, down to the lake. They are hiding in the reeds. I saw them a short while ago. You can't punish them for such a ridiculous incident." He ignores me. A comrade helps him to clamber onto the roof. Balancing on two struts, he begins to stamp holes in the roof with the heel of his boot. I hear the thuds inside as the grass and clay plastering falls. "Stop it," I shout. The blood pounds in my temples. "What have they done to harm you?" I grab at his ankle, but he is too far away. I could tear out his throat in this mood. Someone thrusts himself before me, the friend who helped him up. "Why don't you fuck off?" he murmurs. "Why don't you just fuck off? Why don't you go and die somewhere?" Under the thatch and clay, I hear the roof strut snap cleanly. The man on the roof throws out his hands and plunges through. One moment he is there, his eyes wide with surprise. The next moment there is only a puff of dust hanging in the air. The mat over the doorway is pushed aside, and he staggers out, clutching his hands together, covered from head to toe in ochre dust. "Shit," he says. "Shit, shit, 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 shit." His friends howl with laughter. "It's not funny," he shouts. "I've hurt my fucking thumb." He squeezes his hand between his knees. "It's fucking sore." He swings a kick at the wall of the hut, and again I hear plaster fall inside. "Fucking savages," he says. "We should have lined them up against a wall and shot them long ago. With their friends." Looking past me, looking through me, declining in every way to see me, he swaggers off. As he passes the last hut, he rips off the mat over the doorway. The strings of beads with which it is decorated, red and black berries, dried melon seeds, break and cascade everywhere. I stand in the road waiting for the quivering of rage in me to subside. I think of a young peasant who was once brought before me, in the days when I had jurisdiction over the garrison. He had been committed to the army for 3 years by a magistrate in a far-off town for stealing chickens. After a month here, he tried to desert. He was caught and brought before me. He wanted to see his mother and his sisters again, he said. "We cannot just do as we wish," I lectured him. "We are all subject to the law, which is greater than any of us. The magistrate who sent you here, I myself, you, we are all subject to the law." He looked at me with dull eyes, waiting to hear the punishment, his two stolid escorts behind him, his hands manacled behind his back. "You feel that it is unjust, I know, that you should be punished for having the feelings of a good son. You think you know what is just and what is not. I understand. We all think we know." I had no doubt, myself, then, that at each moment each one of us, man, woman, child, perhaps even the poor old horse turning the mill wheel, knew what was just. All creatures come into the world bringing with them the memory of justice. "But we live in a world of laws," I said to my poor prisoner. "A world of the second best. There is nothing we can do about that. We are fallen creatures. All we can do is to uphold the laws, all of us, without allowing the memory of justice to fade." After lecturing him, I sentenced him. He accepted the sentence without murmur, and his escort marched him away. I remember the uneasy shame I felt on days like that. I would leave the courtroom and return to my apartment, and sit in the rocking chair in the dark all evening, without appetite, until it was time to go to bed. "When some men suffer unjustly," I said to myself, "it is the fate of those who witness their suffering to suffer the shame of it." But the specious consolation of this thought could not comfort me. I toyed more than once with the idea of resigning my post, retiring from public life, buying a small market garden. But then I thought, someone else will be appointed to bear the shame of office, and nothing will have changed. So I continued in my duties, until one day, events overtook me. The two horsemen are less than a mile away, and already beginning to cross the bare fields by the time they are spied. I am one of the crowd that, hearing shouts from the walls, pours out in welcome, for we all recognize the green and gold battalion standard they bear. Among scampering, excited children, I stride across the freshly turned clods. The horseman on the left, who has been riding shoulder to shoulder with his companion, turns away and trots off towards the lakeside track. The other one continues to amble towards us, sitting very erect in the saddle, holding out his arms from his sides, as if intending to embrace us or to fly up into the sky. I begin to run as fast as I can, my sandals dragging in the earth, my heart pounding. 100 yards from him, there is a thud of hooves behind, and 3 armored soldiers gallop past, racing towards the reed breaks into which the other horseman has now disappeared. I join the circle around the man. I recognize him, despite the change, who, with the standard flapping bravely above his head, gazes blankly towards the town. He is lashed to a stout wooden framework, which holds him upright in his saddle. His spine is kept erect by a pole, and his arms are tied to a crosspiece. Flies buzz around his face. His jaw is bound shut, his flesh is puffy. A sickly smell comes from him. He has been several days dead. A child tugs at my hand.
"Is he a barbarian, Uncle?"
he whispers. "No," I whisper back. He turns to the boy next to him.
"You see, I told you,"
he whispers. Since no one else seems prepared to do it, I am the one to whose lot it falls, to pick up the trailing reins and lead these tidings from the barbarians back through the great gates, past the silent watchers to the barracks yard, there to cut their bearer loose and lay him out for burial. The soldiers who set out after his lone companion are soon back. They canter across the square to the courthouse from which Mandel conducts his reign and disappear inside. When they reappear, they will speak to no one. Every premonition of disaster is confirmed, and for the first time, true panic overtakes the town. The shops are swamped with customers bidding against each other for stocks of food. Some families barricade themselves in their houses, herding poultry and even pigs indoors with them. The school is closed. The rumor that a horde of barbarians is camped a few miles away, on the charred riverbanks, that an assault on the town is imminent, flashes from street corner to street corner. The unthinkable has occurred. The army that marched forth so gaily 3 months ago will never return. The great gates are closed and barred. I plead with the sergeant of the watch to allow the fisherfolk inside. They are in terror of their lives, I say. He turns his back on me without reply. Above our heads on the ramparts, the soldiers, the 40 men who stand between us and annihilation, gaze out over lake and desert. At nightfall, on my way to the granary shed where I still sleep, I find my way blocked. A file of two-wheeled horse-drawn commissariat carts passes along the alley. The first loaded with what I recognize as sacks of seed grain from the granary, the others empty. They are followed by a file of horses, saddled and blanketed, from the garrison stables. Every horse I would guess that has been stolen or commandeered in the past weeks. Roused by the noise, people emerge from their houses and stand quietly by, watching this evidently long-planned maneuver of withdrawal. I ask for an interview with Mandel, but the guard at the courthouse is as wooden as all his comrades. In fact, Mandel is not in the courthouse. I return to the square, in time to hear the end of a statement he reads to the public. In the name of the Imperial Command. The withdrawal, he says, is a temporary measure. A caretaker force will be left behind. There is expected to be a general cessation of operations along the front for the duration of the winter. He himself hopes to be back in the spring, when the army will initiate a new offensive. He wishes to thank everyone for the unforgettable hospitality he has been shown. While he speaks, standing in one of the empty carts flanked by soldiers holding torches, his men are returning with the fruits of their foraging. Two struggle to load a handsome cast-iron stove looted from an empty house. Another comes back smiling in triumph, bearing a cock and a hen, the cock a magnificent black and gold creature. Their legs are bound. He grips them by the wings. Their fierce bird eyes glare. While someone holds open the door, he stuffs them into the oven. The cart is piled high with sacks and kegs from a looted shop, even a small table and two chairs. They unfold a heavy red carpet, spread it over the load, lash it down. There is no protest from the people who stand watching this methodical act of betrayal. But I feel currents of helpless anger all about me. The last cart is loaded. The gates are unbarred, the soldiers mount. At the head of the column I can hear someone arguing with Mandel. Just an hour or so, he is saying. They can be ready in an hour. No question of that, replies Mandel, the wind carrying the rest of his words away. A soldier pushes me out of his path and escorts three heavily bundled women to the last cart. They clamber aboard and seat themselves, holding up their veils to their faces. One of them carries a little girl whom she perches on top of the load. Whips crack, the column begins to move, the horses straining, the cartwheels creaking. At the rear of the column come two men with sticks driving a flock of a dozen sheep. As the sheep pass, the murmur in the crowd grows. A young man dashes out waving his arms and shouting. The sheep scatter into the dark, and with a roar, the crowd closes in. Almost at once, the first shots crack out. Running as fast as I can in the midst of scores of other screaming, running people, I retain only a single image of this futile attack. A man grappling with one of the women in the last cart, tearing at her clothes, the child watching wide-eyed with her thumb in her mouth. Then the square is empty and dark again. The last cart trundles through the gates. The garrison is gone. For the rest of the night, the gates stand open, and little family groups, most of them on foot and weighed down under heavy packs, hurry after the soldiers. And before dawn, the fisher folk slink back in, meeting with no resistance, bringing their sickly children and their pitiful possessions, and their bundles of poles and reeds, with which to begin all over again the task of home building. My old apartment stands open. Inside, the air is musty. Nothing has been dusted for a long time. The display cases, the stones and eggs and artifacts from the desert ruins are gone. The furniture in the front room has been pushed against the walls, and the carpet removed. The little parlor seems not to have been touched, but all the drapery carries a sour, stuffy smell. In the bedroom, the bedclothes have been tossed aside with the same motion I use, as if I myself had been sleeping here. The odor from the unwashed linen is alien. The chamber pot under the bed is half full. In the cupboard, there is a crumpled shirt with a ring of brown inside the collar and yellow stains under the armpits. All my clothes are gone. I strip the bed and lie down on the bare mattress, expecting some sense of unease to creep over me, the ghost of another man lingering still among his odors and disorders. The feeling does not come. The room is as familiar as ever. With my arm over my face, I find myself drifting towards sleep. It may be true that the world as it stands is no illusion, no evil dream of a night. It may be that we wake up to it ineluctably, that we can neither forget it nor dispense with it. But I find it as hard as ever to believe that the end is near. If the barbarians were to burst in now, I know I would die in my bed as stupid and ignorant as a baby. And even more apposite would it be if I were caught in the pantry downstairs with a spoon in my hand and my mouth full of fig preserve filched from the last bottle on the shelf. Then my head could be hacked off and tossed onto the pile of heads on the square outside, still wearing a look of hurt and guilty surprise at this eruption of history into the static time of the oasis. To each, his own most fitting end. Some will be caught in dugouts beneath their cellars, clutching their valuables to their breasts, pinching their eyes shut. Some will die on the road, overwhelmed by the first snows of winter. Some few may even die fighting with pitchforks, after which the barbarians will wipe their backsides on the town archives. To the last, we will have learned nothing. In all of us, deep down, there seems to be something granite and unteachable. No one truly believes, despite the hysteria in the streets, that the world of tranquil certainties we were born into is about to be extinguished. No one can accept that an imperial army has been annihilated by men with bows and arrows and rusty old guns who live in tents and never wash and cannot read or write. And who am I to jeer at life-giving illusions? Is there any better way to pass these last days than in dreaming of a savior with a sword who will scatter the enemy hosts and forgive us the errors that have been committed by others in our name and grant us a second chance to build our earthly paradise? I lie on the bare mattress and concentrate on bringing into life the image of myself as a swimmer, swimming with even, untiring strokes through the medium of time, a medium more inert than water, without ripples, pervasive, colorless, odorless, dry as paper. 6. Sometimes in the mornings there are fresh hoofprints in the fields, among the straggling bushes that mark the far limit of the ploughed land. The watchman sees a shape which he swears was not there the day before, and which has vanished a day later. The fisherfolk will not venture out before sunrise. Their catch has dropped so low that they barely subsist. In 2 days of cooperative effort, in which we labored with our weapons at our sides, we have harvested the far fields, all that was left after the flooding. The yield is less than 4 cups a day for each family, but better than nothing. Although the blind horse continues to turn the wheel that fills the tank by the lake shore, that irrigates the gardens of the town, we know that the pipe can be cut at any time, and have already begun with the digging of new wells within the walls. I have urged my fellow citizens to cultivate their kitchen gardens, to plant root vegetables that will withstand the winter frosts. Above all, we must find ways of surviving the winter, I tell them. In the spring, they will send relief. There is no doubt of that. After the first thaw, we can plant 60-day millet. The school has been closed, and the children are employed in trawling the salty southern fingers of the lake for the tiny red crustaceans that abound in the shallows. These we smoke and pack in 1-pound slabs. They have a vile, oily taste. Normally only the fisherfolk eat them. But before the winter is out, I suspect we will all be happy to have rats and insects to devour. Along the north rampart, we have propped a row of helmets with spears upright beside them. Every 30 minutes, a child passes along the row, moving each helmet slightly. Thus do we hope to deceive the keen eyes of the barbarians. The garrison that Mandel bequeathed us consists of 3 men. They take turns in standing guard at the locked courthouse door, ignored by the rest of the town, keeping to themselves. In all measures for our preservation, I have taken the lead. No one has challenged me. My beard is trimmed, I wear clean clothes. I have in effect resumed the legal administration that was interrupted a year ago by the arrival of the civil guard. We ought to be cutting and storing firewood, but no one can be found who will venture into the charred woods along the river, where the fisherfolk swear they have seen fresh signs of barbarian encampments. I am woken by a pounding on the door of my apartment. It is a man with a lantern, wind-burnt, gaunt, out of breath, and a soldier's greatcoat too large for him. He stares at me in bewilderment. "Who are you?" I say. "Where is the warrant officer?" he replies, panting, trying to look over my shoulder. It is 2 o'clock in the morning. The gates have been opened to let in Colonel Joll's carriage, which stands with its shaft resting on the ground in the middle of the square. Several men shelter in its lee against the bitter wind. From the wall, the men of the watch peer down. "We need food, fresh horses, fodder," my visitor is saying. He trots ahead of me, opens the door of the carriage, speaks. "The warrant officer is not here, sir. He has left." At the window, in the moonlight, I catch a glimpse of Joll himself. He sees me, too. The door is slammed shut. I hear the click of the bolt inside. Peering through the glass, I can make him out sitting in the dim far corner, rigidly averting his face. I rap on the glass, but he pays no attention. Then his underlings shoulder me away. Thrown out of the darkness, a stone lands on the roof of the carriage. Another of Joel's escort comes running up.
"There is nothing," he pants. "The stables are empty. They have taken every single one."
The man who has unharnessed the sweating horses begins to curse. A second stone misses the carriage and nearly hits me. They are being thrown from the walls. "Listen to me," I say. "You are cold and tired. Stable the horses, come inside, have something to eat, tell us your story. We have had no news since you left. If that madman wants to sit in his carriage all night, let him sit. They barely listened to me. Famished, exhausted men who have done more than their duty in hauling this policeman to safety, out of the clutches of the barbarians. They whisper together, already reharnessing a pair of their weary horses. I stare through the window at the faint blur against the blackness that is Colonel Jol. My cloak flaps. I shiver from the cold, but also from the tension of suppressed anger. An urge runs through me to smash the glass, to reach in and drag the man out through the jagged hole, to feel his flesh catch and tear on the edges, to hurl him to the ground and kick his body to pulp. As though touched by this murderous current, he reluctantly turns his face towards me. Then he sidles across the seat, until he is looking at me through the glass. His face is naked, washed clean, perhaps by the blue moonlight, perhaps by physical exhaustion. I stare at his pale, high temples. Memories of his mother's soft breast, of the tug in his hand of the first kite he ever flew, as well as of those intimate cruelties for which I abhor him, shelter in that beehive. He looks out at me, his eyes searching my face. The dark lenses are gone. Must he too suppress an urge to reach out, claw me, blind me with splinters? I have a lesson for him that I have long meditated. I mouth the words and watch him read them on my lips. The crime that is latent in us, we must inflict on ourselves, I say. I nod and nod, driving the message home. Not on others, I say. I repeat the words, pointing at my chest, pointing at his. He watches my lips. His thin lips move in imitation, or perhaps in derision, I do not know. Another stone, heavier, perhaps a brick, hits the carriage with a thunderous clatter. He starts. The horses jerk in their traces. Someone comes running up. Go! He shouts. He pushes past me, beats at the door of the carriage. His arms are full of loaves. We must go, he shouts. Colonel Jol slips the bolt and he tumbles the loaves in. The door slams shut. Hurry, he shouts. The carriage heaves into motion, its springs groaning. I grip the man's arm. Wait, I cry. I will not let you go until I know what has happened. Can't you see? He shouts, beating at my grasp. My hands are still weak. To hold him, I have to clasp him in a hug. Tell me and you can go, I pant. The carriage is nearing the gates. The two mounted men have already passed through. The other men run behind. Stones clatter against the carriage out of the darkness. Shouts and curses rain down. What do you want to know? He says, struggling vainly. Where is everyone else? Gone. Scattered. All over the place. I don't know where they are. We had to find our own way. It was impossible to keep together. As his comrades disappear into the night, he wrestles harder. Let me go, he sobs. He is no stronger than a child. In a minute, how could it be that the barbarians did this to you? We froze in the mountains. We starved in the desert. Why did no one tell us it would be like that? We were not beaten. They led us out into the desert, and then they vanished. Who led you? They, the barbarians. They lured us on and on. We could never catch them. They picked off the stragglers. They cut our horses loose in the night. They would not stand up to us.
So you gave up and came home?
Yes.
Do you expect me to believe that?
He glares desperately back at me. Why should I lie? He shouts. I don't want to be left behind. That is all. He tears himself loose. Shielding his head with his hands, he races through the gate and into the darkness. Digging has ceased at the third well site. Some of the diggers have already gone home, others stand around waiting for orders.
What is the trouble?
I say. They point to the bones lying on a heap of fresh earth. A child's bones.
There must have been a grave here,
I say. A strange place for a grave. We are on the vacant plot behind the barracks, between the barracks and the south wall. The bones are old. They have absorbed the color of the red clay.
What do you want to do? We can start digging again nearer the wall if you like.
They help me to climb into the pit. Standing chest deep, I scratch away the earth around the side of a jawbone embedded in the wall.
Here is the skull, I say.
But no, the skull has already been dug up. They show it to me.
Look under your feet, says the foreman.
It is too dark to see, but when I chop lightly with the mattock, I strike something hard. My fingers tell me it is bone.
They aren't buried properly, he says.
He squats at the lip of the pit.
They are lying just any old hell, on top of each other.
Yes, I say.
We can't dig here, can we?
No, he says. We must fill it in and start again, nearer the wall. He is silent. He reaches out a hand and helps me clamber out. The bystanders say nothing either. I have to toss the bones back in and shovel the first earth before they will pick up their spades. In the dream, I stand again in the pit. The earth is damp. Dark water seeps up. My feet squelch. It costs me a slow effort to lift them. I feel under the surface, searching for the bones. My hand comes up with the corner of a jute sack, black, rotten, which crumbles away between my fingers. I dip back into the ooze. A fork, bent and tarnished. A dead bird, a parrot. I hold it by the tail. Its bedraggled feathers hang down. Its soggy wings droop. Its eye sockets are empty. When I release it, it falls through the surface without a splash.
Poisoned water,
I think. I must be careful not to drink here. I must not touch my right hand to my mouth. I have not slept with a woman since I returned from the desert. Now at this most inappropriate of times, my sex begins to reassert itself. I sleep badly, and wake up in the mornings with a sullen erection growing like a branch out of my groin. It has nothing to do with desire. Lying in my rumpled bed, I wait in vain for it to go away. I try to invoke images of the girl who night after night slept here with me. I see her standing, bare-legged in her shift, one foot in the basin, waiting for me to wash her, her hand pressing down on my shoulder. I lather the stocky calf. She slips the shift up over her head. I lather her thighs. Then I put the soap aside, embrace her hips, rub my face in her belly. I can smell the soap, feel the warmth of the water, the pressure of her hands. From the depths of that memory, I reach out to touch myself. There is no leap of response. It is like touching my own wrist. Part of myself, but hard, dull, a limb with no life of its own. I try to bring it off, futile, for there is no feeling. I am tired, I tell myself. For an hour I sit in an armchair waiting for this rod of blood to dwindle. In its own good time it does. Then I dress and go out. In the night it comes back, an arrow growing out of me, pointing nowhere. Again I try to feed it on images, but detect no answering life.
Try bread mold and milk root,
the herbalist says.
It may work. If it does not, come back to me. Here is some milk root. You grind it and mix it to a paste with the mold and a little warm water. Take 2 spoonfuls after each meal. It is very unpleasant, very bitter, but be assured it will not do you any harm.
I pay him in silver. No one but children will take copper coins anymore.
But tell me, he says, why should a fine, healthy man like yourself want to kill off his desires?
It has nothing to do with desire, father. It is simply an irritation, a stiffening, like rheumatism. He smiles. I smile back. This must be the only shop in town they did not loot, I say. It is not a shop, just a recess and a front under an awning, with racks of dusty jars and hanging from hooks on the wall, roots and bunches of dried leaves, the medicines with which he has dosed the town for 50 years.
Yes, they did not trouble me. They suggested that I leave for my own good. The barbarians will fry your balls and eat them. That was what they said. Those were their words. I said, I was born here. I'll die here. I'm not leaving. Now they are gone. And it's better without them, I say.
Yes.
Try the milk root. If it doesn't work, come back.
I drink the bitter concoction and eat as much lettuce as I can, since people say that lettuce takes away one's potency. But I do all this half-heartedly, aware that I am misinterpreting the signs. I also call on Mai. The inn had closed down, there being too little custom. Now she comes in to help her mother in the barracks. I find her in the kitchen, putting her baby to sleep in its cot near the stove.
I love the big old stove you have here, she says. It keeps its warmth for hours. Such a gentle warmth.
She brews tea. We sit at the table watching the glowing coals through the grate.
I wish I had something nice to offer you, she says. But the soldiers cleaned out the storeroom. There is hardly anything left.
I want you to come upstairs with me, I say. Can you leave the child here? We are old friends. Years ago, before she married the second time, she used to visit me in my apartment in the afternoons.
I'd rather not leave him, she says, in case he wakes up alone.
So I wait while she wraps the child and then follow her up the stairs. A young woman still, with a heavy body and shapeless spreading thighs. I try to recall what it was like with her, but cannot. In those days, all women pleased me. She settles the child on cushions in a corner, murmuring to it till it falls asleep again. It is just for a night or two, I say. Everything is coming to an end. We must live as we can. She drops her drawers, trampling on them like a horse, and comes to me in her smock. I blow out the lamp. My words have left me dispirited. As I enter her, she sighs. I rub my cheek against hers. My hand finds her breast. Her own hand closes over it, caresses it, pushes it aside.
I am a bit sore, she whispers, from the baby.
I am still searching for something I want to say when I feel the climax come, far off, slight, like an earth tremor in another part of the world. This is your fourth child, isn't it? We lie side by side under the covers.
Yes, the fourth. One died.
And the father? Does he help?
He left some money behind. He was with the army.
I am sure he will come back. I feel her placid weight against my side. I have grown very fond of your eldest boy, I say. He used to bring me my meals while I was locked up. We lie for a while in silence. Then my head begins to spin. I reemerge from sleep, in time to hear the tail end of a rattle from my throat. An old man's snore. She sits up.
I will have to go, she says. I can't sleep in such bare rooms. I hear creaking all night.
I watch her dim shape move as she dresses and picks up the child.
Can I light the lamp?
She says.
I'm afraid of falling on the stairs. Go to sleep. I will bring you breakfast in the morning, if you don't mind millet porridge. I liked her very much,
she says.
We all did. She never complained. She always did what she was asked, though I know her feet gave her pain. She was friendly. There was always something to laugh about when she was around.
Again, I am as dull as wood. She labors with me. Her big hands stroke my back, grip my buttocks. The climax comes, like a spark struck far away over the sea and lost at once. The baby begins to whimper. She eases herself away from me and gets up. Big and naked, she walks back and forth across the patch of moonlight, with the baby over her shoulder, patting it, crooning.
He will be asleep in a minute, she whispers.
I am half asleep myself, when I feel her cool body settle down again beside me. Her lips nuzzle my arm.
I don't want to think about the barbarians,
she says.
Life is too short to spend worrying about the future.
I have nothing to say.
I don't make you happy,
she says.
I know you don't enjoy it with me. You are always somewhere else.
I wait for her next words.
She told me the same thing. She said you were somewhere else. She could not understand you. She did not know what you wanted from her.
I didn't know you and she were intimate.
I was often here, downstairs. We talked to each other about what was on our minds. Sometimes she would cry and cry and cry. You made her very unhappy. Did you know that?
She is opening a door through which a wind of utter desolation blows on me.
You don't understand, I say huskily.
She shrugs. I go on. There is a whole side to the story you don't know, that she could not have told you because she did not know it herself, which I don't want to talk about now.
It is none of my business.
We are silent, thinking our own thoughts about the girl who tonight sleeps far away under the stars. Perhaps when the barbarians come riding in, I say, she will come riding with them. I imagine her trotting through the open gateway at the head of a troop of horsemen, erect in the saddle, her eyes shining. A forerunner, a guide, pointing out to her comrades the lay of this foreign town, where she once lived. Then everything will be on a new footing. We lie in the dark, thinking.
I am terrified,
she says.
I am terrified to think what is going to become of us. I try to hope for the best and live from day to day, but sometimes all of a sudden I find myself imagining what might happen and I am paralyzed with fear. I don't know what to do anymore. I can only think of the children. What is going to become of the children?
She sits up in the bed.
What is going to become of the children?
She demands vehemently.
They won't harm the children, I tell her. They won't harm anyone.
I stroke her hair, calm her, hold her tight, till it is time again to feed the baby. She sleeps better downstairs in the kitchen, she says. She feels more secure when she can wake up and see the glow of coals in the grate. Also, she likes to have the child with her in the bed. Also, it is better if her mother does not find out where she spends the nights. I too feel it was a mistake and do not visit her again. Sleeping alone, I miss the scent of thyme and onion on her fingertips. For an evening or two, I experience a quiet, fickle sadness before I begin to forget. I stand out in the open, watching the coming of the storm. The sky has been fading. Till now it is bone white with tones of pink rippling in the north. The ochre roof tiles glisten. The air grows luminous. The town shines out shadowless, mysteriously beautiful in these last moments. I climb the wall. Among the armed dummies stand people staring out towards the horizon, where a great cloud of dust and sand already boils up. No one speaks. The sun turns coppery. The boats have all left the lake. The birds have stopped singing. There is an interval of utter silence. Then the wind strikes. In the shelter of our homes, with the windows bolted and bolsters pushed against the doors, with fine grey dust already sifting through roof and ceiling to settle on every uncovered surface, film the drinking water, grate on our teeth, we sit thinking of our fellow creatures out in the open, who at times like this have no recourse but to turn their backs to the wind and endure. In the evenings, in the hour or two I can afford at the fireplace, before my ration of wood gives out, and I must creep into bed, I occupy myself in my old hobbies, repairing as best I can the cases of stones I found smashed and tossed away in the courthouse gardens, toying again with the decipherment of the archaic writing on the poplar slips. It seems right that as a gesture to the people who inhabited the ruins in the desert, we too ought to set down a record of settlement, to be left for posterity, buried under the walls of our town. And to write such a history, no one would seem to be better fitted than our last magistrate. But when I sit down at my writing table, wrapped against the cold in my great old bearskin, with a single candle, for tallow too is rationed, and a pile of yellowed documents at my elbow, what I find myself beginning to write is not the annals of an imperial outpost, or an account of how the people of that outpost spent their last year composing their souls as they waited for the barbarians. No one who paid a visit to this oasis, I write, failed to be struck by the charm of life here. We lived in the time of the seasons, of the harvests, of the migrations of the water birds. We lived with nothing between us and the stars. We would have made any concession, had we only known what, to go on living here. This was paradise on earth. For a long while I stare at the plea I have written. It would be disappointing to know that the poplar slips I have spent so much time on contain a message as devious, as equivocal, as reprehensible as this. Perhaps by the end of the winter, I think, when hunger truly bites us, when we are cold and starving, or when the barbarian is truly at the gate, perhaps then I will abandon the locutions of a civil servant with literary ambitions and begin to tell the truth. I think I wanted to live outside history. I wanted to live outside the history that empire imposes on its subjects, even its lost subjects. I never wished it for the barbarians that they should have the history of empire laid upon them. How can I believe that that is cause for shame? I think I have lived through an eventful year, yet understand no more of it than a babe in arms. Of all the people of this town, I am the one least fitted to write a memorial. Better the blacksmith with his cries of rage and woe, I think. But when the barbarians taste bread, new bread and mulberry jam, bread and gooseberry jam, they will be won over to our ways. They will find that they are unable to live without the skills of men who know how to rear the Pacific grains, without the arts of women who know how to use the benign fruits. I think, when one day people come scratching around in the ruins, they will be more interested in the relics from the desert than in anything I may leave behind. And rightly so. Thus, I spend an evening coating the slips one by one in linseed oil and wrapping them in an oilcloth. When the wind lets up, I promise myself, I will go out and bury them where I found them. I think there has been something staring me in the face, and still I do not see it. The wind has dropped, and now the snowflakes come floating down, the first fall of the year, flecking the roof tiles with white. All morning I stand at my window, watching the snow fall. When I cross the barracks yard, it is already inches deep, and my footsteps crunch with an eerie lightness. In the middle of the square, there are children at play building a snowman. Anxious not to alarm them, but inexplicably joyful, I approach them across the snow. They are not alarmed. They are too busy to cast me a glance. They have completed the great round body. Now they are rolling a ball for the head.
"Someone fetch things for the mouth and nose and eyes," says the child who is their leader.
It strikes me that the snowman will need arms too, but I do not want to interfere. They settle the head on the shoulders and fill it out with pebbles for eyes, ears, nose and mouth. One of them crowns it with his cap. It is not a bad snowman. This is not the scene I dreamed of. Like much else nowadays, I leave it feeling stupid, like a man who lost his way long ago, but presses on along a road that may lead nowhere. This has been an Audible Studios production of Waiting for the Barbarians, written by J.M. Coetzee and performed by Andrew Wincott. Copyright by J.M. Coetzee, 1980. Production copyright 2019 by Audible Limited. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Limited.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.